So I'm Laura Jedwin Chakmak, and I work for the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. And I'm here to talk today about hegemonic masculinity and the psychological psychological well-being of young sexual minority men. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So first we're going to just talk briefly, give a little background and context to the topic, and then explain our theoretical rationale. We'll give a quick description of the sample and procedures, and then talk about the relationship between caregiver-based hegemonic masculinity and young gay and bisexual men's psychological well-being, as well as these findings' implication for practice and future research. And our objectives today are to identify how the parental imposition of hegemonic masculinity impacts the psychological well-being of young men, young sexual minority men, and to consider how family-level interventions might use these findings to redirect parents' motivation to protect their sons away from enforcing hegemonic masculinity and toward enhancing their own sensitivity around issues of gender and sexuality. So a little bit of background information. Primary caregivers play a foundational role in shaping a child's gender identity, and caregivers rarely sit idly by if or when their children, especially sons, exhibit gender nonconforming behaviors. Often policing their son's behavior, parents and guardians actively react to diminish feminine behaviors and encourage traditionally masculine behaviors in sons. In doing such, they enforce hegemonic masculinity, which is defined by Connell as a set of socially accepted masculine behaviors and beliefs designed to legitimate male power. This leaves gender nonconforming young gay and bisexual men vulnerable to considerable stigma from their primary caregivers, resulting from the caregiver's own disapproving attitudes towards gender nonconformity or same-sex attraction. Caregivers may respond in disciplinary ways that attempt to force hegemonic masculinity on their sons. They may do this as a means of influencing behaviors that are inconsistent with their own moral ideals, or as a way of protecting their child or themselves from anticipated societal stigma and discrimination. So we know that pressures to adhere to hegemonic masculinity have been negatively linked to the health and well-being of gay and bisexual youth and adults. And there's been very limited research on the relationship between parent or primary caregiver-based hegemonic masculinity in childhood and mental health in young adulthood. However, a 2006 study by DeGelli, Grossman, and Sparks found that adolescents sampled from an LGBT organization who were perceived as gender nonconforming in childhood were more likely to report more victimization from both parents and social networks, as well as more current adverse mental health symptoms. Did I skip a slide there? Yep. The theoretical rationale of this analysis is based on minority stress theory. According to the minority stress model, messages designed to impose hegemonic masculinity are forms of discrimination and societal stigma, which may facilitate gay and bisexual men's susceptibility to psychological stress. In this analysis, we examine the association between being told by a primary caregiver to act less feminine and mental health outcomes, as well as the relationship between the disciplinary actions taken to change feminine behavior and mental health outcomes. So this analysis was conducted from the Virtual Love Study, which was an online cross-sectional observational study investigating single, young sexual minority men's partner-seeking behaviors online. The sample consisted of 1,507 participants who self-identified as male, had sex with men, were between the ages of 18 and 24, reported being single, and were residents of the United States, including Puerto Rico. Most of the participants in the sample identified as gay, but the remaining identified as bisexual, same-gender loving, MSM, or straight. So in the online survey, we asked participants, did your parents or the persons who raised you ever tell you to act less feminine? And if they answered yes, we asked, what did they do to try to make you change? They could choose from a few options, including told me to change my behavior, punished me or restricted my activities, sent me to counseling, sent me to talk to a religious figure, or other, in which case there was a write-in box where that they where they could write in their own answers. Self-esteem was measured using the Rosenberg self-esteem scale, and so participants indicated how strongly they agreed or disagreed with 10 statements, which included things such as, on the whole, I am satisfied with myself, or I am inclined to feel that I am a failure. Depression was measured using the Center for Epidemiological Studies depression scale, which lists 10 statements such as, I was bothered by things that don't usually bother me, or I could not get going. Participants were asked how often in the past week that they had felt that way. Anxiety was measured using the anxiety subscale of the brief symptom inventory in response to a list of 6 feelings, such as nervousness or shakiness inside, and feeling so restless that you couldn't sit still. Participants indicated how often that they had felt that way in the past week. And of course, a range of socio-demographic variables were measured. Those controlled for in this analysis include age, race, educational attainment, and current student status, whether they're a student, full-time, part-time, or not at all. Excuse me. So we ran 2 models for each psychological well-being outcome, including self-esteem, symptoms of depression, and symptoms of anxiety. The first model observed the relationship between being told to stop acting feminine and psychological well-being, while the second model observed how the number of disciplinary actions taken or that were experienced by participants who were told to stop acting feminine associated with psychological well-being. First, in response to the question, did your parents or the persons who raised you ever tell you to act less feminine, over 1/3 of the participants, 564 of them, reported being told to act less feminine by a primary caregiver. So this was not an uncommon experience within the sample. The most frequently noted disciplinary action in response to being told to act less feminine was just to being told to change one's behavior. Nearly 35% of the entire sample reported being told to change their behavior. Other common disciplinary actions included being punished or having one's activities restricted or being sent to a counselor and being sent to a religious figure. 38 participants reported experiences of mental and physical abuse, and 9 participants reported being enrolled into traditionally masculine activities such as football. Participants were given the option to report multiple disciplinary actions that were enacted to change their behaviors, and we categorized them as having experienced 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4 or more of these disciplinary actions. So first we looked at self-esteem, and after measuring, after accounting for the demographic covariates, we found a relationship between being told to stop acting feminine and lower self-esteem that was significant at the p is less than 0.001 value. And then for the second model, after adjusting again for age, education, race, and student status, we found a dose-response relationship between the number of disciplinary actions enacted in response to feminine behavior and self-esteem, where additional disciplinary actions increased the likelihood of lower self-esteem. Next, we focused our analysis on symptoms of depression. We found a relationship between being told to stop acting feminine and increased symptoms of depression. And as we expected in the second model, we also found a dose-response relationship between the number of disciplinary actions experienced by those who were told to stop acting feminine and increased symptoms of depression, even after accounting for age, educational attainment, race categories, and student status. And then finally, we focused our analysis on symptoms of anxiety. We found a statistically significant relationship between being told to stop acting feminine and increased symptoms of anxiety, again after adjusting for these demographic covariates. And again, in the second model for anxiety, we observed a statistically significant relationship between the number of disciplinary actions that were taken and symptoms of anxiety among the participants who were told to stop acting feminine, with a greater number of disciplinary actions experienced associated with increased anxiety symptoms. So what are the implications of these findings? I believe these findings have implications for developing family-based interventions for caregivers of gender nonconforming boys and young sexual minority men, as well as application in family counseling or related settings. Because gender nonconformity is often coupled with same-sex attraction, caregivers may discourage feminine behaviors in sons as a proxy for discouraging same-sex attraction. In general, parents do not criticize or attempt to change their son's behavior out of malice. Qualitative studies have found that many parents often do so out of a desire to help their child avoid societal stigma. Many caregivers see their actions as an expression of love. Unfortunately, in so doing, they impose their own stigma within the family system. The current findings lend support to the importance of educating families on how their disciplinary actions affect same-sex attracted youth into emergent adulthood. Family-based interventions and counseling can capitalize upon parents' desire to protect their sons. By teaching caregivers that the long-lasting negative effects of their comments and these disciplinary actions, it may be possible to redirect this motivation to protect their sons away from enforcing hegemonic masculinity and towards accepting their son as he is, enhancing their own sensitivity around gender and sexuality in the process. Caitlin Ryan's Family Acceptance Project has had success with a similar family intervention on teaching accepting versus rejecting behaviors for families of LGBT youth. So some strengths of this analysis include that the study included a large national sample of young sexual minority men, which allowed us to see a dosage effect. The dosage hypothesis in itself is a strength. Not only were we able to investigate the relationship between mental health and the presence or absence of these disciplinary actions to decrease femininity, but we were also able to see how that relationship varied depending on the number of disciplinary actions experienced. Finally, in this analysis, we started to examine how these experiences in childhood and adolescence regarding gender conformity have implications into emergent adulthood, carrying over from one developmental period to another. Limitations of this analysis included the fact that, although it was a large national sample, it was a convenient sample that was recruited online and is not representative. This sample also only included sexual minority men, but future research could expand this question to include heterosexual men as well. Another limitation was that it was a cross-sectional study. So future research should really include some longitudinal studies where we could follow children from childhood into adulthood. And then having this real-time data would also limit recall bias. We must also acknowledge the self-report bias inherent in this type of research. And future research could ask both parents and children about these experiences. And finally, there are also limitations related to the measurement of the disciplinary actions. This analysis looked at just the number of different disciplinary actions that were taken, but it's unclear whether some types of disciplinary actions carry more weight than others. We didn't have information on the frequency of these disciplinary actions, the age at which they began, or how long that they were occurring. And finally, we only measured gender in this analysis, but there could be other policing that's going on. So moving forward, it will be important to examine policing related to other aspects of identity as well. I'd like to acknowledge that NIMH that funded the Virtual Love Study, the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities, the research group, as well as, of course, the participants in the Virtual Love Study, without whom we would not have this data. So thank you so much.